Chapter 14. The Turn of Poland. On October 24, 1938, less than a month after Munich, Ribbentrop was host to Józef Lipski, the Polish ambassador in Berlin, at a three-hour lunch at the Grand Hotel in Berchtesgaden. Poland, like Germany, and indeed in connivance with her, had just seized a strip of Czech territory. The luncheon talk proceeded, as a German Foreign Office memorandum stressed, in a very friendly atmosphere. Nevertheless, the Nazi foreign minister lost little time in getting down to business. The time had come, he said, for a general settlement between Poland and Germany. It was necessary, first of all, he continued, to speak with Poland about Danzig. It should revert to Germany. Also, Ribbentrop said, the Reich wished to build a supermotor highway and a double-track railroad across the Polish corridor to connect Germany with Danzig and East Prussia. Both would have to enjoy extraterritorial rights. Finally, Hitler wished Poland to join the Anti-Comintern Pact against Russia. In return for all these concessions, Germany would be willing to extend the Polish-German treaty by from 10 to 20 years and guarantee Poland's frontiers. Ribbentrop emphasized he was broaching these problems in strict confidence. He suggested that the ambassador make his report to Foreign Minister Beck orally, since otherwise there was great danger of its leaking out, especially to the press. Lipski promised to report to Warsaw, but warned Ribbentrop that personally he saw no possibility of the return of Danzig to Germany. He further reminded the German foreign minister of two recent occasions, November 5, 1937 and January 14, 1938, when Hitler had personally assured the Poles that he would not support any change in the Danzig statute. Ribbentrop replied that he did not wish an answer now, but advised the Poles to think it over. The government in Warsaw did not need much time to collect its thoughts. A week later, on October 31st, Foreign Minister Beck dispatched detailed instructions to his ambassador in Berlin on how to answer the Germans. But it was not until November 19th that the latter was able to secure an interview with Ribbentrop. The Nazis obviously wanted the Poles to consider well their response. It was negative. As a gesture of understanding, Poland was willing to replace the League of Nations guarantee of Danzig with a German-Polish agreement about the status of the Free City. Any other solution, Beck wrote in a memorandum which Lipski read to Ribbentrop, and in particular any attempt to incorporate the Free City into the Reich must inevitably lead to conflict. And he added that Marshal Pilsudski, the late dictator of Poland, had warned the Germans in 1934 during the negotiations for a non-aggression pact that the Danzig question was a sure criterion for estimating Germany's intentions toward Poland. Such a reply was not to Ribbentrop's taste. He regretted the position taken by Beck and advised the Poles that it was worth the trouble to give serious consideration to the German proposals. Hitler's response to Poland's rebuff on Danzig was more drastic. On November 24th, 5 days after the Ribbentrop-Lipski meeting, he issued another directive to the commanders-in-chief of the armed forces. Top secret. The Führer has ordered, apart from the three contingencies mentioned in the instructions of 10-21-38, the three contingencies were the liquidation of the rest of Czechoslovakia, occupation of Memel, and protection of the Reich's frontiers. Preparations are also to be made to enable the Free State of Danzig to be occupied by German troops by surprise. The preparations will be made on the following basis. Condition is a quasi-revolutionary occupation of Danzig, exploiting a politically favorable situation, not a war against Poland. The troops to be employed for this purpose must not simultaneously be earmarked for the occupation of the Memelland, so that both operations can, if necessary, take place simultaneously. The Navy will support the Army's operation by attack from the sea. The plans of the branches of the armed forces are to be submitted by January 10, 1939. Though Beck had just warned that an attempt by Germany to take Danzig would lead inevitably to conflict, Hitler now convinced himself that it could be done without a war. Local Nazis controlled Danzig, and they took their orders, as had the Sudeteners, from Berlin. It would not be difficult to stir up a quasi-revolutionary situation there. Thus, as 1938 approached its end, the year that had seen the bloodless occupation of Austria and the Sudetenland, Hitler was preoccupied with further conquest. the remainder of Czechoslovakia, Memel, and Danzig. It had been easy to humble Schuschnigg and Beneš. Now it was Josef Beck's turn. Yet when the Führer received the Polish foreign minister at Berchtesgaden shortly after New Year's, on January 5, 1939, he was not yet prepared to give him the treatment which he had meted out to Schuschnigg and was shortly to apply to President Hacke. The rest of Czechoslovakia would have to be liquidated first. Hitler, as the secret Polish and German minutes of the meeting make clear, was in one of his more conciliatory moods. He was quite ready, he began, to be at Beck's service. Was there anything special, he asked, on the Polish foreign minister's mind? Beck replied that Danzig was on his mind. It became obvious that it had also been on Hitler's. Danzig is German, the Führer reminded his guest. We'll always remain German and will sooner or later become part of Germany. He could give the assurance, however, that no fait accompli would be engineered in Danzig. He wanted Danzig, and he wanted a German highway and railroad across the corridor. If he and Beck would depart from old patterns and seek solutions along entirely new lines, he was sure they could reach an agreement which would do justice to both countries. Beck was not so sure, though, as he confided to Ribbentrop the next day, he did not want to be too blunt with the Führer. He had replied that the Danzig problem was a very difficult one. He did not see in the Chancellor's suggestion any equivalent for Poland. Hitler thereupon pointed out the great advantage to Poland of having her frontier with Germany, including the corridor, secured by treaty. This apparently did not impress Beck, but in the end he agreed to think the problem over further. After mulling it over that night, the Polish foreign minister had a talk with Ribbentrop the next day in Munich. He requested him to inform the Führer that whereas all his previous talks with the Germans had filled him with optimism, he was today, after his meeting with Hitler, for the first time in a pessimistic mood, particularly in regard to Danzig, as it had been raised by the Chancellor. He saw no possibility whatever of agreement. It had taken Colonel Beck, like so many others who have figured in these pages, some time to awaken and to arrive at such a pessimistic view. Like most Poles, he was violently anti-Russian. Moreover, he disliked the French, for whom he had nursed a grudge since 1923, when, as Polish military attaché in Paris, he had been expelled for allegedly selling documents relating to the French army. Perhaps it had been natural for this man, who had become Polish foreign minister in November 1932, to turn to Germany. For the Nazi dictatorship, he had felt a warm sympathy from the beginning, and over the past 6 years, he had striven to bring his country closer to the Third Reich and to weaken its traditional ties with France. Of all the countries that lay on the borders of Germany, Poland had, in the long run, the most to fear. Of all the countries, it had been the most blind to the German danger. No other provision of the Versailles Treaty had been resented by the Germans as much as that which established the corridor, giving Poland access to the sea, and cutting off East Prussia from the Reich. The detachment of the old Hanseatic port of Danzig from Germany and its creation as a free city under the supervision of the League of Nations, but dominated economically by Poland, had equally outraged German public opinion. Even the weak and peaceful Weimar Republic had never accepted what it regarded as the Polish mutilation of the German Reich. As far back as 1922, General von Seeckt, as we have seen, had defined the German army's attitude. Poland's existence is intolerable and incompatible with the essential conditions of Germany's life. Poland must go, and will go, as a result of her own internal weaknesses and of action by Russia, with our aid. The obliteration of Poland must be one of the fundamental drives of German policy, and is attainable by means of, and with the help of, Russia. Prophetic words. The Germans forgot, or perhaps did not wish to remember, that almost all of the German land awarded Poland at Versailles, including the provinces of Posen and Polish Pomerania, Pomorza, which formed the corridor, had been grabbed by Prussia at the time of the partitions when Prussia, Russia, and Austria had destroyed the Polish nation. For more than a millennium it had been inhabited by Poles, and to a large extent it still was. No nation recreated by Versailles had had such a rough time as Poland. In the first turbulent years of its rebirth it had waged aggressive war against Russia, Lithuania, Germany, and even Czechoslovakia, in the last instance over the coal-rich Teschen area. Deprived of their political freedom for a century and a half, and thus without modern experience in self-rule, the Poles were unable to establish stable government or to begin to solve their economic and agrarian problems. In 1926, Marshal Pilsudski, the hero of the 1918 revolution, had marched on Warsaw, seized control of the government, and, though an old-time socialist, had gradually replaced a chaotic democratic regime with his own dictatorship. One of his last acts, before his death in 1935, was to sign a treaty of non-aggression with Hitler. This took place on January 26, 1934, and, as has been recounted, was one of the first steps in the undermining of France's system of alliances with Germany's eastern neighbors, and in the weakening of the League of Nations and its concept of collective security. After Pilsudski's death, Poland was largely governed by a small band of colonels, leaders of Pilsudski's old Polish legion, which had fought against Russia during the First World War. At the head of these was Marshal Szmigli-Ritz, a capable soldier but in no way a statesman. Foreign policy drifted into the hands of Colonel Beck. From 1934 on, it became increasingly pro-German. This was bound to be a policy of suicide. And indeed, when one considers Poland's position in post-Versailles Europe, it is difficult to escape the conclusion that the Poles in the 1930s, as on occasions in the centuries before, were driven by some fateful flaw in their national character toward self-destruction, and that in this period, as sometimes formerly, they were their own worst enemies. As long as Danzig and the Corridor existed as they were, there could be no lasting peace between Poland and Nazi Germany. Nor was Poland strong enough to afford the luxury of being at odds with both her giant neighbors, Russia and Germany. Her relations with the Soviet Union had been uniformly bad since 1920, when Poland had attacked Russia, already weakened by the World War and the Civil War, and a savage conflict had followed. As a result of that war, Poland pushed its eastern boundary 150 miles east of the ethnographic Curzon Line, at the expense of the Soviet Union, a frontier which transferred 4.5 million Ukrainians and 1.5 million white Russians to Polish rule. Thus, Poland's western and eastern borders were unacceptable to Germany and Russia, respectively, a fact which seems to have been lost sight of in the Western democracies when Berlin and Moscow began to draw together in the summer of 1939. Seizing an opportunity to gain the friendship of a country so stoutly anti-Russian, and at the same time to detach her from Geneva and Paris, thus undermining the system of Versailles, Hitler had taken the initiative in bringing about the Polish-German Pact of 1934. It was not a popular move in Germany. The German army, which had been pro-Russian and anti-Polish since the days of Zeitz, resented it. But it served Hitler admirably for the time being. Poland's sympathetic friendship helped him to get first things done first: the reoccupation of the Rhineland, the destruction of independent Austria and Czechoslovakia. On all of these steps, which strengthened Germany, weakened the West, and threatened the East, Beck and his fellow colonels in Warsaw looked on benevolently and with utter and inexplicable blindness. If the Polish foreign minister at the very start of the new year had, as he said, been plunged into a pessimistic mood by Hitler's demands, his spirits sank much lower with the coming of spring. Though in his anniversary speech to the Reichstag on January 30, 1939, Hitler spoke in warm terms of the friendship between Germany and Poland, and declared that it was one of the reassuring factors in the political life in Europe, Ribbentrop had talked with more frankness when he paid a state visit to Warsaw 4 days before. He again raised with Beck the question of Hitler's demands concerning Danzig and communications through the corridor, insisting that they were extremely moderate. But neither on these questions, nor on his insistence that Poland join the anti-Comintern pact against the Soviet Union, did the German foreign minister get a satisfactory answer. Colonel Beck was becoming wary of his friends. As a matter of fact, he was beginning to squirm. On February 26th, the German ambassador in Warsaw informed Berlin that Beck had taken the initiative in getting himself invited to visit London at the end of March, and that he might go to Paris afterward. Though it was late in the day, Poland, as Moltke put it in his dispatch, desires to get in touch with the Western democracies, for fear that a conflict might arise with Germany over Danzig. With Beck, too, as with so many others who had tried to appease the ravenous appetite of Adolf Hitler, the scales were falling from the eyes. They fell completely and forever on March 15th when Hitler occupied Bohemia and Moravia and sent his troops to protect independent Slovakia. Poland woke up that morning to find itself flanked in the south along the Slovak border, as it already was in the north on the frontiers of Pomerania and East Prussia, by the German army. Its military position had overnight become untenable. March 21, 1939, is a day to be remembered in the story of Europe's march toward war. There was intense diplomatic activity that day in Berlin, Warsaw, and London. The President of the French Republic, accompanied by Foreign Minister Bonnet, arrived in the British capital for a state visit. To the French, Chamberlain suggested that their two countries join Poland and the Soviet Union in a formal declaration stating that the four nations would consult immediately about steps to halt further aggression in Europe. 3 days before, Litvinov had proposed, as he had just a year before after the Anschluss, a European conference, this time of France, Britain, Poland, Russia, Romania, and Turkey, which would join together to stop Hitler. But the British Prime Minister had found the idea premature. He was highly distrustful of Moscow and thought a declaration by the four powers, including the Soviet Union, was as far as he could go. "I must confess," Chamberlain wrote in a private letter on March 26th, "to the most profound distrust of Russia. I have no belief whatever in her ability to maintain an effective offensive, even if she wanted to, and I distrust her motives. Moreover, she is both hated and suspected by many of the smaller states, notably by Poland, Romania, and Finland." Filing, The Life of Neville Chamberlain, page 603. His proposal was presented to Beck in Warsaw by the British ambassador on the same day, March 21st, and received a somewhat cool reception as far as including the Russians was concerned. The Polish foreign minister was even more distrustful of the Soviet Union than Chamberlain, and, moreover, shared the Prime Minister's views about the worthlessness of Russian military aid. He was to hold these views unflinchingly right up to the moment of disaster. But the most fateful event of this day of March 21st for Poland took place in Berlin. Ribbentrop invited the Polish ambassador to call on him at noon. For the first time, as Lipsky noted in a subsequent report, the foreign minister was not only cool toward him, but aggressive. The Führer, he warned, was becoming increasingly amazed at Poland's attitude. Germany wanted a satisfactory reply to her demands for Danzig and a highway and railroad through the corridor. This was a condition for continued friendly Polish-German relations. Poland must realize, Ribbentrop laid it down, that she could not take a middle course between Russia and Germany. Her only salvation was a reasonable relationship with Germany and her Führer. That included a joint anti-Soviet policy. Moreover, the Führer desired Beck to pay an early visit to Berlin. In the meantime, Ribbentrop strongly advised the Polish ambassador to hurry to Warsaw and explain to his foreign minister in person what the situation was. He advised, Lipsky informed Beck, that the talk with Hitler should not be delayed, lest the Chancellor should come to the conclusion that Poland was rejecting all his offers. A slight aggression, by the by. Before leaving the Wilhelmstrasse, Lipsky had asked Ribbentrop whether he could tell him anything about his conversation with the foreign minister of Lithuania. The German replied that they had discussed the memo question, which called for a solution. As a matter of fact, Ribbentrop had received the Lithuanian foreign minister, Juozas Urbšys, who was passing through Berlin after a trip to Rome, on the previous day, and demanded that Lithuania hand back the Memel district to Germany forthwith. Otherwise, the Führer would act with lightning speed. The Lithuanians, he warned, must not deceive themselves by expecting some kind of help from abroad. Actually, some months before, on December 12, 1938, the French ambassador and the British chargé d'affaires had called the attention of the German government to reports that the German population of Memel was planning a revolt, and had asked it to use its influence to see that the Memel Statute guaranteed by both Britain and France, was respected. The Foreign Office reply had expressed surprise and astonishment at the Anglo-French démarche, and Ribbentrop had ordered that if there were any further such steps, the two embassies should be told that we had really expected that the French and British would finally become tired of meddling in Germany's affairs. For some time, the German government, and particularly the party and SS leaders, had been organizing the Germans of Memel along lines with which we are now familiar from the Austrian and Sudeten affairs. The German armed forces had also been called in to cooperate, and, as we have seen, 3 weeks after Munich, Hitler had ordered his military chiefs to prepare, along with the liquidation of the remainder of Czechoslovakia, the occupation of Memel. Since the Navy had had no opportunity for glory in the march in to landlocked Austria and Sudetenland, Hitler decided that Memel should be taken from the sea. In November, naval plans for the venture were drawn up under the code name Transport Exercise Stettin. Hitler and Admiral Raeder were so keen on this little display of naval might that they actually put to sea from Swinemünde aboard the pocket battleship Deutschland for Memel on March 22nd, exactly a week after the Führer's triumphant entry into Prague, before defenseless Lithuania had time to capitulate to a German ultimatum. On March 21st, Weizsäcker, who much later would proclaim his distaste for the brutality of Nazi methods, notified the Lithuanian government that there was no time to lose, and that its plenipotentiaries must come to Berlin by special plane tomorrow to sign away to Germany the district of Memel. The Lithuanians had obediently arrived late in the afternoon of March 22nd, but despite German pressure administered in person by Ribbentrop, egged on by a seasick Hitler aboard his battleship at sea, they took their time about capitulating. Twice during the night, the captured German documents reveal, the Führer got off urgent radiograms from the Deutschland to Ribbentrop, asking whether the Lithuanians had surrendered as requested. The dictator and his admiral had to know whether they must shoot their way into the port of Memel. Finally, at 1:30 a.m. on March 23rd, Ribbentrop was able to transmit by radio to his master the news that the Lithuanians had signed. At 2:30 in the afternoon of the 23rd, Hitler made another of his triumphant entries into a newly occupied city, and at the Stadttheater in Memel again addressed a delirious, liberated German throng. Another provision of the Versailles Treaty had been torn up. Another bloodless conquest had been made. Although the Führer could not know it, it was to be the last. The heat on Poland. The German annexation of the Memelland came as a very unpleasant surprise to the Polish government, as the German ambassador to Poland, Hans Adolf von Moltke, reported to Berlin from Warsaw on the following day. The main reason for this, he added, is that it is generally feared that now it will be the turn of Danzig and the corridor. He also informed the German Foreign Office that Polish reservists were being called up. The next day, March 25th, Admiral Canaris, chief of the Abwehr, reported that Poland had mobilized three classes and was concentrating troops around Danzig. General Keitel did not believe this showed any aggressive intentions on the part of the Poles, but the Army General Staff, he noted, took a somewhat more serious view. Hitler returned to Berlin from Memel on March 24th, and on the next day had a long talk with General von Brauchitsch, the commander-in-chief of the army. From the latter's confidential memorandum of the conversation, it appears that the leader had not yet made up his mind exactly how to proceed against Poland. In fact, his turbulent brain seemed to be full of contradictions. Ambassador Lipsky was due back on the next day, March 26th, and the Führer did not want to see him. Lipsky will return from Warsaw on Sunday, March 26th, Brauchitsch noted. He was commissioned to ask whether Poland would be prepared to come to some terms with regard to Danzig. The Führer left during the night of March 25th. He does not wish to be here when Lipsky returns. Ribbentrop shall negotiate it first. The Führer does not wish, though, to solve the Danzig problem by force. He would not like to drive Poland into the arms of Great Britain by doing so. A military occupation of Danzig would have to be taken into consideration only if Lipsky gives a hint that the Polish government could not take the responsibility toward their own people to cede Danzig voluntarily, and the solution would be made easier for them by a fait accompli. This is an interesting insight into Hitler's mind and character at this moment. 3 months before, he had personally assured Beck that there would be no German fait accompli in Danzig. Yet he remembered that the Polish foreign minister had stressed that the Polish people would never stand for turning over Danzig to Germany. If the Germans merely seized it, would not this fait accompli make it easier for the Polish government to accept it? Hitherto, Hitler had been a genius at sizing up the weaknesses of his foreign opponents and taking advantage of them. But here, for almost the first time, his judgment has begun to falter. The colonels who governed Poland were a mediocre and muddling lot, but the last thing they wanted or would accept was a fait accompli in Danzig. The Free City was uppermost in Hitler's mind, but he was also thinking beyond it, just as he had done in regard to Czechoslovakia after Munich had given him the Sudetenland. For the time being, Brauchitsch noted, the Führer does not intend to solve the Polish question. However, it should be worked on. A solution in the near future would have to be based on especially favorable political conditions. In that case, Poland shall be knocked down so completely that it need not be taken into account as a political factor for the next few decades. The Führer has in mind, as such a solution, a borderline advanced from the eastern border of East Prussia to the eastern tip of Upper Silesia. Brauchitsch well knew what that border signified. It was Germany's pre-war eastern frontier, which Versailles had destroyed, and which had prevailed as long as there was no Poland. If Hitler had any doubts as to what the Polish reply would be, they were dissipated when Ambassador Lipsky returned to Berlin on Sunday, March 26th, and presented his country's answer in the form of a written memorandum. Ribbentrop read it at once, rejected it, stormed about Polish mobilization measures, and warned the envoy of possible consequences. He also declared that any violation of Danzig territory by Polish troops would be regarded as aggression against the Reich. Poland's written response, while couched in conciliatory language, was a firm rejection of the German demands. It expressed willingness to discuss further means of facilitating German rail and road traffic across the corridor, but refused to consider making such communications extraterritorial. As for Danzig, Poland was willing to replace the League of Nations status by a Polish-German guarantee, but not to see the Free City become a part of Germany. Nazi Germany, by this time, was not accustomed to see a smaller nation turning down its demands, and Ribbentrop remarked to Lipsky that it reminded him of certain risky steps taken by another state, an obvious reference to Czechoslovakia, which Poland had helped Hitler to dismember. It must have been equally obvious to Lipsky, when he was summoned again to the Foreign Office the next day by Ribbentrop, that the Third Reich would now resort to the same tactics against Poland which had been used so successfully against Austria and Czechoslovakia. The Nazi foreign minister raged at the alleged persecution of the German minority in Poland, which he said had created a disastrous impression in Germany. In conclusion, the German foreign minister remarked that he could no longer understand the Polish government. The proposals transmitted yesterday by the Polish ambassador could not be regarded as a basis for a settlement. Relations between the two countries were therefore rapidly deteriorating. Warsaw was not so easily intimidated as Vienna and Prague. The next day, March 28th, Beck sent for the German ambassador and told him, in answer to Ribbentrop's declaration that a Polish coup against Danzig would signify a casus belli, that he in turn was forced to state that any attempt by Germany or the Nazi Danzig Senate to alter the status of the Free City would be regarded by Poland as a casus belli. "You want to negotiate at the point of a bayonet," exclaimed the ambassador. "This is your own method," Beck replied. The reawakened Polish foreign minister could afford to stand up to Berlin more firmly than Benesch had been able to do, for he knew that the British government, which a year before had been anxious to help Hitler obtain his demands against Czechoslovakia, was now taking precisely the opposite course in regard to Poland. Beck himself had torpedoed the British proposal for a four-power declaration, declaring that Poland refused to associate itself with Russia in any manner. Instead, on March 22nd, he had suggested to Sir Howard Kennard the British ambassador in Warsaw, the immediate conclusion of a secret Anglo-Polish agreement for consultation in case of a threatened attack by a third power. But, alarmed by German troop movements adjacent to Danzig and the corridor, and by British intelligence concerning German demands on Poland, which the tricky Beck had denied to the British, Chamberlain and Halifax wanted to go further than mere consultations. On the evening of March 30th, Kennard presented to Beck an Anglo-French proposal for mutual assistance pacts in case of German aggression. In the telegram of instructions to Kennard, it was made clear that Russia was to be left out in the cold. "It is becoming clear," it said, "that our attempts to consolidate the situation will be frustrated if the Soviet Union is openly associated with the initiation of the scheme. Recent telegrams from a number of His Majesty's missions abroad have warned us that the inclusion of Russia would not only jeopardize the success of our constructive effort, but also tend to consolidate the relations of the parties to the Anti-Comintern Pact, as well as excite anxiety among a number of friendly governments." But even this step was overtaken by events. Fresh reports of the possibility of an imminent German attack on Poland prompted the British government on the same evening to ask Beck whether he had any objection to an interim unilateral British guarantee of Poland's independence. Chamberlain had to know by the morrow, as he wished to answer a parliamentary question on the subject. Beck, his sense of relief may be imagined, had no objection. In fact, he told Kennard, he agreed without hesitation. The next day, March 31st, as we have seen, Chamberlain made his historic declaration in the House of Commons that Britain and France would lend the Polish government all support in their power if Poland were attacked and resisted. To anyone in Berlin that weekend when March 1939 came to an end, as this writer happened to be, the sudden British unilateral guarantee of Poland seemed incomprehensible, however welcome it might be in the lands to the west and the east of Germany. Time after time, as we have seen, in 1936, when the Germans marched into the demilitarized Rhineland, in 1938, when they took Austria and threatened a European war to take the Sudetenland, even a fortnight before, when they grabbed Czechoslovakia, Great Britain and France, backed by Russia, could have taken action to stop Hitler at very little cost to themselves. But the peace-hungry Chamberlain had shied away from such moves. Not only that, he had gone out of his way. He had risked, as he said, his political career to help Adolf Hitler get what he wanted in the neighboring lands. He had done nothing to save the independence of Austria. He had consorted with the German dictator to destroy the independence of Czechoslovakia, the only truly democratic nation on Germany's eastern borders, and the only one which was a friend of the West and which supported the League of Nations and the idea of collective security. He had not even considered the military value to the west of Czechoslovakia's 35 well-trained, well-armed divisions entrenched behind their strong mountain fortifications at a time when Britain could put only 2 divisions in France, and when the German army was incapable of fighting on 2 fronts, and, according to the German generals, even incapable of penetrating the Czech defenses. Now, overnight, in his understandably bitter reaction to Hitler's occupation of the rest of Czechoslovakia, Chamberlain, after having deliberately and recklessly thrown so much away, had undertaken to unilaterally guarantee an eastern country run by a junta of politically inept colonels, who up to this moment had closely collaborated with Hitler, who, like hyenas, had joined the Germans in the carving up of Czechoslovakia, and whose country had been rendered militarily indefensible by the very German conquests which Britain and Poland had helped the Reich to achieve. And he had taken this 11th-hour risk without bothering to enlist the aid of Russia, whose proposals for joint action against further Nazi aggression he had twice turned down within the year. Finally, he had done exactly what for more than a year he had stoutly asserted that Britain would never do. He had left to another nation the decision whether his country would go to war. Chamberlain could not have been ignorant of Poland's military weakness. Colonel Sword, the British military attaché in Warsaw, had sent to London a week before, on March 22nd, a long report on the disastrous strategic position of Poland, bounded on 3 sides by Germany, and on the deficiencies of the Polish armed forces, especially in modern arms and equipment. On April 6th, while Colonel Beck was in London discussing a mutual assistance pact, Colonel Sword and also the British air attaché in Warsaw, Group Captain Vachel, sent fresh reports which were even less hopeful. Vachel emphasized that during the next 12 months the Polish Air Force would have no more than about 600 aircraft, many of which are no match for German aircraft. Sword reported that the Polish Army and Air Force were both so lacking in modern equipment that they could put up only a limited resistance to an all-out German attack. Ambassador Kennard, summing up his attaché's reports, informed London that the Poles would be unable to defend the corridor or the western frontier against Germany, and would have to fall back on the Vistula in the heart of Poland. A friendly Russia, he added, was thus of paramount importance for Poland. Nevertheless, the Prime Minister's precipitate step, belated as it was, presented Adolf Hitler with an entirely new situation. From now on, apparently, Britain would stand in the way of his committing further aggression. He could no longer use the technique of taking one nation at a time while the Western democracies stood aside debating what to do. Moreover, Chamberlain's move appeared to be the first serious step toward forming a coalition of powers against Germany, which, unless it were successfully countered, might bring again that very encirclement which had been the nightmare of the Reich since Bismarck. Case White. The news of Chamberlain's guarantee of Poland threw the German dictator into one of his characteristic rages. He happened to be with Admiral Canaris, chief of the Abwehr, and according to the latter, he stormed about the room, pounding his fists on the marble tabletop, his face contorted with fury, and shouting against the British, "I'll cook them a stew they'll choke on." The next day, April 1st, he spoke at Wilhelmshaven at the launching of the battleship Tirpitz, and was in such a belligerent mood that apparently he did not quite trust himself, for at the last moment he ordered that the direct radio broadcast of his speech be cancelled. He directed that it be rebroadcast later from recordings, which could be edited. Actually, the relay of the broadcast to the American radio networks was cut off after Hitler had begun to speak. This led to reports in New York that he had been assassinated. I was in the control room of the shortwave section of the German Broadcasting Company in Berlin, looking after the relay to the Columbia Broadcasting System in New York, when the broadcast was suddenly shut off. To my protests, German officials answered that the order had come from Hitler himself. Within 15 minutes, CBS was telephoning me from New York to check on the assassination report. I could easily deny it because through an open telephone circuit to Wilhelmshaven, I could hear Hitler shouting his speech. It would have been difficult to shoot the Führer that day because he spoke behind a bulletproof glass enclosure. Even the rebroadcast version was spotted with warnings to Britain and Poland. If they, the Western Allies, expect the Germany of today to sit patiently by until the very last day while they create satellite states and set them against Germany, then they are mistaking the Germany of today for the Germany of before the war. He who declares himself ready to pull the chestnuts out of the fire for these powers must realize he burns his fingers. When they say in other countries that they will arm and will keep arming still more, I can tell those statesmen only this: me, you will never tire out. I am determined to continue on this road. Hitler, as his cancellation of the direct broadcast showed, was cautious enough not to provoke foreign opinion too much. It was reported in Berlin that day that he would denounce the Anglo-German naval treaty as his first reply to Chamberlain. But in his speech he merely declared that if Great Britain no longer wished to adhere to it, Germany would accept this very calmly. As so often before, Hitler ended on an old familiar note of peace. Germany has no intention of attacking other people. Out of this conviction, I decided 3 weeks ago to name the coming party rally the Party Convention of Peace, a slogan which, as the summer of 1939 developed, became more and more ironic. That was for public consumption. In the greatest of secrecy, Hitler gave his real answer to Chamberlain and Colonel Beck 2 days later, on April 3rd. It was contained in a top-secret directive to the armed forces, of which only 5 copies were made, inaugurating Case White. This was a code name which was to loom large in the subsequent history of the world. Top Secret. Case White. The present attitude of Poland requires the initiation of military preparations to remove, if necessary, any threat from this direction forever. 1. Political requirements and aims. The aim will be to destroy Polish military strength and create in the East a situation which satisfies the requirements of national defense. The Free State of Danzig will be proclaimed a part of the Reich territory at the outbreak of hostilities at the latest. The political leaders consider it their task in this case to isolate Poland if possible, that is to say, to limit the war to Poland only. The development of increasing internal crises in France and the resulting British cautiousness might produce such a situation in the not-too-distant future. Intervention by Russia cannot be expected to be of any use to Poland. Italy's attitude is determined by the Rome-Berlin axis. 2. Military conclusions. The great objectives in the building up of the German armed forces will continue to be determined by the antagonism of the Western democracies. Case White constitutes only a precautionary complement to these preparations. The isolation of Poland will be all the more easily maintained, even after the outbreak of hostilities, if we succeed in starting the war with sudden, heavy blows and in gaining rapid successes. 3. Tasks of the armed forces. The task of the Wehrmacht is to destroy the Polish armed forces. To this end, a surprise attack is to be aimed at and prepared. As for Danzig, surprise occupation of Danzig may become possible independently of Case White by exploiting a favorable political situation. Occupation by the army will be carried out from East Prussia. The navy will support the action of the army by intervention from the sea. Case White is a lengthy document with several enclosures, annexes, and special orders, most of which were reissued as a whole on April 11th, and of course added to later as the time for hostilities approached. But already on April 3rd, Hitler appended the following directives to Case White. 1. Preparations must be made in such a way that the operation can be carried out at any time from September 1, 1939 onward. As in the case of the date Hitler gave long in advance for getting the Sudetenland, October 1, 1938, this more important date of September 1, 1939 would also be kept. 2. The High Command of the Armed Forces, OKW, is charged with drawing up a precise timetable for Case White and is to arrange for synchronized timing between the three branches of the Wehrmacht. 3. The plans of the branches of the Wehrmacht and the details for the timetable must be submitted to OKW by May 1, 1939. The question now was whether Hitler could wear down the Poles to the point of accepting his demands, as he had done with the Austrians and, with Chamberlain's help, the Czechs, or whether Poland would hold its ground and resist Nazi aggression if it came, and if so, with what. This writer spent the first week of April in Poland in search of answers. They were, as far as he could see, that the Poles would not give in to Hitler's threats, would fight if their land were invaded, but that militarily and politically they were in a disastrous position. Their air force was obsolete, their army cumbersome, their strategic position, surrounded by the Germans on three sides, almost hopeless. Moreover, the strengthening of Germany's west wall made an Anglo-French offensive against Germany in case Poland were attacked extremely difficult. And finally, it became obvious that the headstrong Polish colonels would never consent to receiving Russian help, even if the Germans were at the gates of Warsaw. Events now moved quickly. On April 6th, Colonel Beck signed an agreement with Great Britain in London, transforming the unilateral British guarantee into a temporary pact of mutual assistance. A permanent treaty, it was announced, would be signed as soon as the details had been worked out. The next day, April 7th, Mussolini sent his troops into Albania and added the conquest of that mountainous little country to that of Ethiopia. It gave him a springboard against Greece and Yugoslavia, and in the tense atmosphere of Europe, served to make more jittery the small countries which dared to defy the Axis. As the German Foreign Office papers make clear, it was done with the complete approval of Germany, which was informed of the step in advance. On April 13th, France and Britain countered with a guarantee to Greece and Romania. The two sides were beginning to line up. In the middle of April, Goering arrived in Rome and much to Ribbentrop's annoyance, had two long talks with Mussolini on the 15th and 16th. They agreed that they needed 2 or 3 years to prepare for a general conflict, but Goering declared that if war came sooner, the Axis was in a very strong position and could defeat any likely opponents. Mention was made of an appeal from President Roosevelt, which had arrived in Rome and Berlin on April 15th. The Duce, according to Ciano, had at first refused to read it, and Goering declared that it was not worth answering. Mussolini thought it a result of infantile paralysis, but Goering's impression was that Roosevelt was suffering from an incipient mental disease. In his telegram to Hitler and Mussolini, the President of the United States had addressed a blunt question. Are you willing to give assurance that your armed forces will not attack or invade the territory of the following independent nations? There had followed a list of 31 countries, including Poland, the Baltic states, Russia, Denmark, the Netherlands, Belgium, France, and Britain. The president hoped that such a guarantee of non-aggression could be given for 10 years at the least, or a quarter of a century if we dare look that far ahead. If it were given, he promised American participation in worldwide discussions to relieve the world from the crushing burden of armament and to open up avenues of international trade. You have repeatedly asserted, he reminded Hitler, that you and the German people have no desire for war. If this is true, there need be no war. In the light of what now is known, this seemed like a naive appeal, but the Führer found it embarrassing enough to let it be known that he would reply to it. Not directly, but in a speech to a specially convoked session of the Reichstag on April 28th. In the meantime, as the captured German Foreign Office papers reveal, the Wilhelmstrasse, in a circular telegram of April 17th, put two questions of its own to all the states mentioned by Roosevelt, except Poland, Russia, Britain, and France. Did they feel themselves in any way threatened by Germany? Had they authorized Roosevelt to make this proposal? We are in no doubt, Ribbentrop wired his various envoys in the countries concerned, that both questions will be answered in the negative, but nevertheless, for special reasons, we should like to have authentic confirmation at once. The special reasons would become evident when Hitler spoke on April 28th. By April 22nd, the German Foreign Office was able to draw up a report for the Führer that most of the countries, including Yugoslavia, Belgium, Denmark, Norway, the Netherlands, and Luxembourg, have answered both questions in the negative. A reply which would soon show what an innocent view their governments took of the Third Reich. From Romania, however, came a tart answer that the Reich government were themselves in a position to know whether a threat might arise. Little Latvia, up in the Baltic, did not at first understand what answer was expected of it, but the Foreign Office soon put it right. On April 18th, Weizsäcker rang up his minister in Riga to tell him we were unable to understand the answer of the Latvian foreign minister to our question about the Roosevelt telegram. While practically all the other governments have already answered, and naturally in the negative, Monsieur Munters treated this ridiculous American propaganda as a question on which he wished to consult his cabinet. If Monsieur Munters did not answer no to our question right away, we should have to add Latvia to those countries which made themselves into willing accomplices of Mr. Roosevelt. I said that I assumed that a word on these lines by Herr von Kotze, the German minister, would be enough to obtain the obvious answer from him. It was. Hitler's reply to Roosevelt. The replies were potent ammunition for Hitler, and he made masterly use of them as he swung into his speech to the Reichstag on the pleasant spring day of April 28, 1939. It was, I believe, the longest major public speech he ever made, taking more than 2 hours to deliver. In many ways, especially in the power of its appeal to Germans and to the friends of Nazi Germany abroad, it was probably the most brilliant oration he ever gave, certainly the greatest this writer ever heard from him. For sheer eloquence, craftiness, irony, sarcasm, and hypocrisy, it reached a new level that he was never to approach again. And though prepared for German ears, it was broadcast not only on old German radio stations, but on hundreds of others throughout the world. In the United States, it was carried by the major networks. Never before or afterward was there such a worldwide audience as he had that day. On the day of the speech, Weizsäcker wired Hans Thompson, German chargé in Washington, instructing him to give the Führer's address the widest possible publicity in the United States, and assuring him that extra funds would be provided for the purpose. On May 1st, Thompson replied, "Interest in speech surpasses anything so far known. I have therefore directed that the English text printed here is to be sent to tens of thousands of addressees of all classes and callings, in accordance with the agreed plan. Claim for costs to follow." The speech began, after the usual introductory dissertation on the iniquities of Versailles and the many injustices and long suffering heaped upon the German people by it, with an answer first to Great Britain and Poland, which shook an uneasy Europe. After declaring his feeling of admiration and friendship for England, and then attacking it for its distrust of him and its new policy of encirclement of Germany, he denounced the Anglo-German naval treaty of 1935. "The basis for it," he said, "has been removed." Likewise with Poland. He made known his proposal to Poland concerning Danzig and the corridor, which had been kept secret, called it the greatest imaginable concession in the interests of European peace, and informed the Reichstag that the Polish government had rejected this one and only offer. "I have regretted this incomprehensible attitude of the Polish government. The worst is that now Poland, like Czechoslovakia a year ago, believes, under pressure of a lying international campaign, that it must call up troops, although Germany has not called up a single man, and had not thought of proceeding in any way against Poland. This is in itself very regrettable, and posterity will one day decide whether it was really right to refuse this suggestion, made this once by me, a truly unique compromise." "Reports that Germany intended to attack Poland," Hitler went on, "were mere inventions of the international press. Not one of the tens of millions of persons listening could know that only 3 weeks before he had given written orders to his armed forces to prepare for the destruction of Poland by September 1st at the latest. The inventions of the press," he continued, "had led Poland to make its agreement with Great Britain, which, under certain circumstances, would compel Poland to take military action against Germany. Therefore, Poland had broken the Polish-German non-aggression pact. Therefore, I look upon the agreement as having been unilaterally infringed by Poland and thereby no longer in existence." Having himself unilaterally torn up two formal treaties, Hitler then told the Reichstag that he was willing to negotiate replacements for them. "I can but welcome such an idea," he exclaimed. "No one would be happier than I at the prospect." This was an old trick he had pulled often before when he had broken a treaty, as we have seen, but though he probably did not know it, it would no longer work. Hitler next turned to President Roosevelt, and here the German dictator reached the summit of his oratory. To a normal ear, to be sure, it reeked with hypocrisy and deception, but to the hand-picked members of the Reichstag and to millions of Germans, its masterly sarcasm and irony were a delight. The paunchy deputies rocked with raucous laughter as the Führer uttered with increasing effect his seemingly endless ridicule of the American president. One by one he took up the points of Roosevelt's telegram, paused, almost smiled, and then, like a schoolmaster, uttered in a low voice one word, "Answer," and gave it. This writer can still, in his mind, see Hitler pausing time after time to say quietly, "Antwort," while above the rostrum in the president's chair, Göring tried ineffectually to stifle a snicker, and the members of the Reichstag prepared, as soon as the Antwort was given, to roar and laugh. "Mr. Roosevelt declares that it is clear to him that all international problems can be solved at the council table." "Answer. I would be very happy if these problems could really find their solution at the council table. My skepticism, however, is based on the fact that it was America herself who gave sharpest expression to her mistrust in the effectiveness of conferences. For the greatest conference of all time was the League of Nations, representing all the peoples of the world, created in accordance with the will of an American president. The first state, however, that shrank from this endeavor was the United States. It was not until after years of purposeless participation that I resolved to follow the example of America. The freedom of North America was not achieved at the conference table any more than the conflict between the North and the South was decided there. I will say nothing about the innumerable struggles which finally led to the subjugation of the North American continent as a whole. I mention all this only in order to show that your view, Mr. Roosevelt, although undoubtedly deserving of all honor, finds no confirmation in the history of your own country or of the rest of the world. Germany, Hitler reminded the president, had once gone to a conference at Versailles, not to discuss, but to be told what to do. Its representatives were subjected to even greater degradations than can ever have been inflicted on the chieftains of the Sioux tribes. Hitler finally got to the core of his answer to the president's request that he give assurances not to attack any of 31 nations. Answer. How has Mr. Roosevelt learned which nations consider themselves threatened by German policy and which do not? Or is Mr. Roosevelt in a position, in spite of the enormous amount of work which must rest upon him in his own country, to recognize of his own accord all these inner spiritual and mental impressions of other peoples and their governments? Finally, Mr. Roosevelt asks that assurance be given him that the German armed forces will not attack, and above all not invade the territory or possessions of the following independent nations. Hitler then read out slowly the name of each country, and as he intoned the names, I remember, the laughter in the Reichstag grew. Not one member, no one in Berlin, I believe, including this writer, noticed that he slyly left out Poland. Hitler now pulled the ace out of the pack, or so he must have thought. Answer. I have taken the trouble to ascertain from the states mentioned, firstly, whether they feel themselves threatened, and secondly, and above all, whether this inquiry by the American president was addressed to us at their suggestion, or at any rate with their consent. The reply was in all cases negative. It is true that I could not cause inquiries to be made of certain of the states and nations mentioned, because they themselves, as for example Syria, are at present not in possession of their freedom, but are occupied and consequently deprived of their rights by the military agents of democratic states. Apart from this fact, however, all states bordering on Germany have received much more binding assurances than Mr. Roosevelt asked from me in his curious telegram. I must draw Mr. Roosevelt's attention to one or two historical errors. He mentioned Ireland, for instance, and asks for a statement that Germany will not attack Ireland. Now, I have just read a speech by De Valera, the Irish Taoiseach, Hitler was careful to use the Gaelic word for Prime Minister, in which, strangely enough, and contrary to Mr. Roosevelt's opinion, he does not charge Germany with oppressing Ireland, but he reproaches England with subjecting Ireland to continuous aggression. In the same way, the fact has obviously escaped Mr. Roosevelt's notice that Palestine is at present occupied not by German troops, but by the English, and that the country is having its liberty restricted by the most brutal resort to force. Nevertheless, said Hitler, he was prepared to give each of the states named an assurance of the kind desired by Mr. Roosevelt. But more than that, his eyes lit up. I should not like to let this opportunity pass without giving above all to the President of the United States an assurance regarding those territories which would, after all, give him most cause for apprehension, namely the United States itself and the other states of the American continent. I here solemnly declare that all the assertions which have been circulated in any way concerning an intended German attack or invasion on or in American territory are rank frauds and gross untruths, quite apart from the fact that such assertions, as far as the military possibilities are concerned, could have their origin only in a stupid imagination. The Reichstag rocked with laughter. Hitler did not crack a smile, maintaining with great effect his solemn mien. And then came the peroration, the most eloquent for German ears, I believe, he ever made. Mr. Roosevelt, I fully understand that the vastness of your nation and the immense wealth of your country allow you to feel responsible for the history of the whole world and for the history of all nations. I, sir, am placed in a much more modest and smaller sphere. I once took over a state which was faced by complete ruin, thanks to its trust in the promises of the rest of the world and to the bad regime of democratic governments. I have conquered chaos in Germany, re-established order and enormously increased production, developed traffic, caused mighty roads to be built and canals to be dug, called into being gigantic new factories, and at the same time endeavored to further the education and culture of our people. I have succeeded in finding useful work once more for the whole of the 7 million unemployed. Not only have I united the German people politically, but I have also rearmed them. I have also endeavored to destroy, sheet by sheet, that treaty which in its 448 articles contains the vilest oppression which peoples and human beings have ever been expected to put up with. I have brought back to the Reich provinces stolen from us in 1919. I have led back to their native country millions of Germans who were torn away from us and were in misery. And, Mr. Roosevelt, without spilling blood and without bringing to my people and consequently to others the misery of war. You, Mr. Roosevelt, have a much easier task in comparison. You became President of the United States in 1933 when I became Chancellor of the Reich. From the very outset, you stepped to the head of one of the largest and wealthiest states in the world. Conditions prevailing in your country are on such a large scale that you can find time and leisure to give your attention to universal problems. Your concerns and suggestions cover a much larger and wider area than mine. Because my world, Mr. Roosevelt, in which Providence has placed me and for which I am therefore obliged to work, is unfortunately much smaller, although for me it is more precious than anything else, for it is limited to my people. I believe, however, that this is the way in which I can be of the most service to that for which we are all concerned, namely, the justice, well-being, progress, and peace of the whole community. In the hoodwinking of the German people, this speech was Hitler's greatest masterpiece. But as one traveled about Europe in the preceding days, it was easy to see that, unlike a number of Hitler's previous orations, this one no longer fooled the people or the governments abroad. In contrast to the Germans, they were able to see through the maze of deceptions, and they realized that the German Führer, for all his masterful oratory, though scoring off Roosevelt, had not really answered the president's fundamental questions. Had he finished with aggression? Would he attack Poland? As it turned out, this was the last great peacetime public speech of Hitler's life. The former Austrian waif had come as far in this world as was possible by the genius of his oratory. From now on, he was to try to make his niche in history as a warrior. Retiring for the summer to his mountain retreat at Berchtesgaden, Hitler did not publicly respond to the Polish answer to him which was given on May 5th in a speech by Colonel Beck to Parliament, and in an official government memorandum presented to Germany on that date. The Polish statement and Beck's speech constituted a dignified, conciliatory, but also firm reply. "It is clear," it said, "that negotiations, in which one state formulates demands and the other is obliged to accept those demands unaltered, are not negotiations."